Ways and Means Public Safety Subcommittee for Wednesday, March 16, 2005. A public hearing on Senate Bill 5530, the Oregon Youth Authority. And I'd like to call forward the agency director, Bob Jester. And are you bringing up Debbie Rios for this panel?
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Bob Jester, and I am looking at page 16 of the presentation document. And we concluded yesterday with a description of our organization chart, which is on the top half of the page. And I would like to introduce to this committee Debbie Rios, who is the assistant administrator for our program office and will be presenting the service delivery model that the Youth Authority uses.
Great. Thank you. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Debbie Rios, Assistant Director with the Program Office. And I'm going to be speaking today about how OYA delivers services to youth, and more specifically, how we deliver evidence-based services. So I'm going to start on page 17 of the document. The ultimate goal of the Oregon Youth Authority's work with offenders is for there not to be any new crime. And in our efforts to achieve this, we provide services that protect the public, ensure accountability, promote change, improve skills, and reduce the likelihood of youth committing any more crime. Each youth that comes to the Oregon Youth Authority has a set of risks and needs that need specific interventions and services. On page 17, you'll see the many partners that the Oregon Youth Authority works with in the delivery of services, from the juvenile departments to the schools to youth advocates to families to the faith community. In the center of the circle, you see a youth, and this demonstrates some of the needs that the youth come to the Oregon Youth Authority with. And so when we're delivering services, the parole officer might work with an assistant principal to assist with education needs, might work with a private provider to work with drug and alcohol, and other partners that are here to work and develop plans for the youth. Funding in the OYA's budget supports services through the juvenile departments. We have the diversion, juvenile crime prevention, and gang services. Through our providers, we have residential, foster, and individual services. And then the Oregon Youth Authority has the case management and close custody services. On page 18, you will see a diagram that is up here on the board. The Oregon Youth Authority has redesigned our services to make them evidence-based, and they're constructed around principles of effective intervention. These principles have been proven over the past 10 years to favorably impact the reduction of recidivism. So the Youth Authority uses a four-step model. We assess, we plan, we implement, and we evaluate. The cycle starts with assessment, and when a youth comes into the Youth Authority and is committed, within the first 30 days, a standardized risk needs assessment is performed on the youth. And this is usually done by the parole officer or a case manager that's in one of the correctional facilities. The first step is to determine the overall risk for the youth to reoffend. Is it low? Is it moderate? Or is it high? The next thing that the parole officer works on is to identify the criminogenic needs that must be addressed to reduce the risk of reoffending. Some examples of the needs might be substance abuse, a need for sex offender treatment, problems in school, family relations. The parole officer then looks at what protective factors does the youth have, what skills or assets do the youth have that can resist future criminal behavior. We may have a case where a youth has a history of being expelled from school, suspended from school, poor academic functioning in school. But now the youth is attending school, they're excelling academically, they're involved in other school activities, they're relating to some adults within the school, and these are seen as protective factors that can help resist the youth from being involved in any new crime. The last piece in the assessment stage is to look at how the youth may respond to treatment. And so the parole officer looks at the different characteristics that the youth may have to help determine how they might respond. The parole officer will look at a youth with mental health problems that's very anxious in terms of how they respond versus a youth that has low cognitive functioning. Likewise, the parole officer would look at young youthful women responding differently than their older youthful offenders, male offenders. So once this assessment stage is complete, they now move to the planning stage. The Oregon Youth Authority plans our treatment in multidisciplinary teams. So in a facility, the team would consist of the treatment manager, the school, the qualified mental health professional, the youth, the family, and parole officer. In the community, these teams are made up of some of the partners that I've just talked about. When we plan the treatment, we target the most intensive programs for the highest risk youth. We also match the treatment to the youth's needs and assets. So we look at their learning style, we look at what their needs are, and we match that to the program that they're going to be in. The next stage of our services is that of implementation. We implement services and interventions that are proven to reduce new crime. We select treatment curricula that target some of these criminogenic risks and needs. The research tells us three very important things when we're looking at implementing programs. First, that the programs need to be behavioral and action-oriented. The second is that the services, family-based services, are very important with youthful offenders, particularly those offenders that are transitioning home. The third piece is that we must reinforce the youth for doing the right things, for behaving in pro-social manners.
May I ask a question here related to the research and the findings? What does the research say about the importance of a spiritual foundation, about the place of faith-based organizations in around effective intervention? It seems to be missing from what I'm hearing thus far.
Madam Chair, where the spiritual-based piece comes into play is supporting the youth with their needs, supporting some of their cultural values, and addressing some of the spiritual needs that the youth may have. One example of how we use the faith community is with mentors and try to identify individuals that can serve as a mentor to the youth. Another piece is assisting us with youth that don't have families, and to provide a role, not only a spiritual supportive type of role, but also a family to come and visit the youth.
Your response tells me what you do, but it doesn't respond to the question I asked, which is about what does the research say about the place of a spiritual foundation and the place of faith-based approaches to intervention.
I'm not aware of specific research that is specific to spiritual interventions, but one piece that the research is very clear on is the pro-social models and the pro-social values and attitudes that the faith community can provide to the youth. But, Madam Chair, we'll research that.
Mm-hmm. I would appreciate your doing that. it just seems to me that in our community-based approaches, given the role that the faith community plays in, can play, that we need to be looking at where and how we might make a stronger connection. And my own observation is that a lot of the young people, I'm looking at page 19 now, and I'm looking at the risk need assessment instrument. If I were going to add a circle to that wheel, frankly, I would add spiritual foundation. It can be argued that there are a lot of young people out there who are just spiritually adrift. I know that's an uncomfortable conversation for a lot of people to have who want to separate, you know, church and state and all the rest of it. But there is something happening out there with our young people that has to do with their spiritual core or absence of, and how and also has to do with popular culture, and how a lot of our young people are being seduced by the images in popular culture. And so I know there's got to be some recent research out there that talks about this, and I'm wondering how you all are accessing that information and research, and how you're drawing on it to inform your programmatic decisions.
Madam Chair, I agree with what you're saying, and I my experience in seeing spiritual individuals coming into the facilities on a special night. I've seen the youth really look forward to that. I've seen the youth respond very favorably to spiritual guidance. We've had prison ministries, various churches that are very much involved in our youth correctional facilities, as well as in the community. And the wonderful thing about having individuals from the spiritual parts of our community is that when youth are out, once they've been released, they may come into contact with them, and they can continue to be very positive. We have had some spiritual communities that are interested in developing foster homes for youth, as well as other special kinds of events for our youth. So I can say that I've seen in many cases where youth in the Youth Authority have benefited greatly with the faith community.
And then I'll just add one other comment and go back to you. With an administration that is currently promoting faith-based initiatives, I'm wondering, are there opportunities there that you all have been looking at? And if you could talk to us about that now or at some point, that would be helpful.
Madam Chair, I have seen some grants, opportunities through the administration, but I haven't seen any yet that focus just on youthful offenders, but certainly we'll keep our eyes open with that.
Okay. Thank you. Please continue.
Okay. The other piece in the implementation stage is staff training, and we really value the importance of well-trained staff. The staff need to know the skills and competence and have confidence in providing these evidence-based services. Once we complete or have the implementation stage start providing interventions and services to youth, then we begin evaluation. And the parole officer will evaluate the youth's response every 30 days. How are they responding to the provisions of services that we have? And continue kind of looking. And so if the youth is having some difficulties, we will make some adjustments in the case plan. And we might find a mentor for the youth, or we might have the youth involved in these activities. And we continue this process of ongoing kind of review, assisting the youth, until the point that we find that they're ready to go to another residential setting. And then we plan for the youth with a team that's involved where the youth is currently residing and the team where the youth is going to go, and look at those different partners and how we can put together a plan that will work for that particular youth. We'd like to move to page 19, and this is where we share with you a little bit of the projects that we've been working on in the last year. The first one is the Risk Needs Assessment Instrument, which you've heard a bit about. And the diagram that you see on this page are the domain areas that the individual youth is looked at. And so we'll look at their criminal history, but their school, the relationships that they have with others, their family, and look at those kinds of areas. We've trained over 250 staff in the use of this instrument, and we have fully committed the risk needs assessment, and all of the youth in both our close custody and community settings, and approximately 80% of the youth are determined to be at high risk of reoffending. On page 20, we have our automated case plan. And
Representative Wisner.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
This is Riaz. Okay, so we screen them and they're 80%. So, you know, we're going to talk about, you know, a year from now, is that, you know, is your treatment, has it come down? Is that, we're going to talk about that later. This is when they're entering your program, I'm assuming.
Yes, that's correct. I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I didn't practice very well.
Okay,
Lonnie did much better than I.
You're doing fine.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, yes.
You screen them and then screen. This is initial screening, and then later you're going to go back and tell me your treatment's brought that down.
Yes, what we identify where their risks and needs are, and then we look at developing some of those protective factors. So if the youth has a problem with drug and alcohol and is found to be at high risk of drug and alcohol, what we would work on is providing treatment for that, monitoring the use of alcohol and drugs, looking at relapse plans for the youth, assist the youth in determining activities that are incongruent with the use of drugs and alcohol, working with the youth to develop pro-social skills. And so those are kinds of things that we would do that would reduce the overall risk. And then when we're looking at releasing a youth to a less restrictive setting, we look at what those risks are, what treatment and interventions have happened, and where the youth is overall.
Sure. Representative Hanna.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. So are these youth that aren't incarcerated then?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, these youth that we do the risk needs assessment are those that are in our youth correctional facilities as well as those that are in our community programs.
Maybe I misunderstood. Follow up, please. Why would we be monitoring their drug and alcohol use when they're incarcerated? I thought maybe they were in going back somehow, but...
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, we look at what their drug and alcohol use has prior to them being committed to the Oregon Youth Authority. When our youth are in community settings, we do monitor any use of drugs and alcohol, and any use of that would keep the youth at a higher risk of committing a new offense.
One more follow-up. Do we have evidence of drug and alcohol use in the facilities?
Madam Chair, pardon? Oh, Representative Hanna, Mr. Florip will be addressing that when he's presenting on the facilities.
Please continue.
You'll see the automated case plan that we have, and on page 20, when the risk needs assessment is completed, that information goes into JGIS, to the Juvenile Justice Information System, and the case it's drawn upon in developing the case plan. And so they'll see where the youth has certain needs, they'll see where they have different strengths, and then they develop that plan. They determine long-term goals and competencies, and this plan is looked at every 90 days. When the case plan is continues over the treatment of wherever the youth is. So if the youth changes settings or if their case manager changes, this case plan is constant for them. So you can see how the youth is able to do over time with our automated case plan. We've also focused much energy on the design and delivery of treatment programs, developing treatment protocols in drug and alcohol treatment, fire setting treatment, and we have benefited from the National Institute of Corrections in training and technical assistance in cognitive behavioral programs, and the Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration will be providing training and technical assistance to us in the area of drug and alcohol treatment. The last component that we've been working on has been quality assurance. And what we do is we monitor our activities to...
Thank you, Representative Patterson.
I'm assuming the answer to this question is yes. You know, I can see from your display here this planning tool that you have that's online, and it looks like you've opened up one here and you have all these things you could potentially mark off or rate. I assume there's also the ability to enter a narrative somewhere on the plan for some of these, so that you're not just picking like multiple choice options or rating options, that you can actually enter a narrative also of.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, that's absolutely correct. That information, the items can be individualized, and the response is always narrative.
Please continue.
With our quality assurance programs, we monitor our services to assure that we're providing them as they've been designed and that we're providing them and they're done well. I'd like to just end with a little bit of information on our compliance with Senate Bill 267. As you all know, this was passed by the 2003 legislative session that requires treatment or intervention programs which are intended to reduce criminal behavior to be evidence-based. And the Youth Authority is involved with four other state agencies with this legislation. We first started by developing a coordinating committee where all the state agencies are working together and coordinating our responses and services. The Oregon Youth Authority coordinated with Portland State University and the University of Cincinnati and had all of our close custody facilities evaluated using the Correctional Program Assessment Inventory. And this inventory examines critical programs, client assessments, leadership, and treatment that's provided. Each facility has an improvement plan, and we plan on reassessing these later this year. The University of Cincinnati also trained 24 individuals throughout the state and county and local programs for the use of the Correction Program Assessment Inventory. This gives us the opportunity to independently evaluate our programs throughout the criminal justice system throughout the state.
How many of those 24 individuals are people of color?
Madam Chair, I'll have to go through the list and get that.
Thank you. Please.
The Oregon Youth Authority has also established services and interventions subject to Senate Bill 267, where we've identified in both our close custody facilities as well as our community settings what services are subject to this law. And examples would be drug and alcohol treatment, family-based treatment, mental health crisis intervention, transition services. The Oregon Youth Authority has conducted assessments on over half of our residential programs providing behavioral rehabilitation services, and over half of them are determined to be satisfactory or very satisfactory. We've implemented staff training, and we have our methods in place for quality assurance. So I'd like to say that we are prepared to be in compliance with Senate Bill 267 for the 2005-2007 biennium.
Can you also, in the satisfactory and very satisfactory categories, it would be more meaningful if we knew the numbers behind each of those categories. How many were satisfactory? What does satisfactory mean? And then very satisfactory, same thing. What are the numbers? And then what is very satisfactory?
And I'm sure I'll be more
distinction.
Than happy to get that for you.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, I've finished my section.
Okay. Thank you very much. And you did a great job.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, for the record, my name is Bob Jester, and I am now on page 22, Agency Outcomes and Statewide Juvenile Recidivism. And this recidivism definition is found in ORS 420.012 and is a measure of public safety. Recidivism is defined as a new criminal referral. And a referral is a law enforcement report to a juvenile department alleging one or more felony and or misdemeanor acts. And I think that there is a tremendous amount of importance on the recidivism data that we are going to be talking about today, and that this is the ultimate measure and the ultimate goal of the outcome of all of the services and programs, staff training, the contracts that we do in the community, as well as those that come into our facilities, is to reduce the risk and the likelihood of reoffense among the cohort of youth that we serve, and to make them most ready for reentry into a less structured setting. Recidivism is always comprised of four variables. And the first is a definition of people, or the who. So who are the group of youth or youth offenders that you are going to be looking at? The second is when, the date that we are tracking that group of youth, when. The what is the event that would indicate recidivism, and a length of time that we are tracking, which would also be the when. So in the case of the juvenile recidivism, we are, if you look at the chart at the bottom of the page, we are looking at those youth who have had a referral during a calendar year. That's the who. And the when starts during that calendar year, when the individual has had a referral to the juvenile court. And then we track that individual out 12 months. This is across the state, all juveniles who have had referrals to juvenile court. And if you look at 1995 as an example, top of the chart, you will see that number is 22,329 juveniles were referred to juvenile court during that year, 1995. The next column is the number of offenders who recidivated within 12 months. That number is 8,500. And the percentage of youth who have recidivated during 12 months from the year 1995 is 38.1%. So the recidivism on the statewide definition, and this is the broadest net of a referral. It is not an adjudication. It is referral to a juvenile court, either on a felony or a misdemeanor law violation. A couple of points that are important to make around juvenile recidivism as a whole. Number one is the number of juvenile offenders is declining every year, both nationally and in the state of Oregon. Number two, the juvenile justice recidivism rate has declined steadily over the past 9 years.
Mr. Jester, Representative Hanna has a question. Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Jester, when we say the number is declining, is that because the population of that group is declining, or per capita is it declining?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, is the per capita is declining?
It is. All right.
Senator Devlin?
Matt.
Do we have evidence that it's declining in terms of occurrence, or are more potential offenders getting diverted from the system so that they're not actually entering the system?
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, excuse me. Based on the recidivism data, that would be a law enforcement referral. So whether diversion at the juvenile department level occurred, that would be included in this number.
Oh, it would be.
Okay. These are a total number that were referred to juvenile departments. It's the broadest net. Now, if a police officer stopped a young person and went no further with that, then that would not count here. For the past 2 years, the statewide juvenile justice average recidivism is 32%. So on average, one-third of the youth who commit a crime will commit another crime within 12 months. Conversely, two-thirds of the youth who commit a crime do not commit another crime within 12 months. And this is the recidivism data, as you see. The last year that we have data for completed is 2003. Again, that rate is 32%.
What this doesn't tell us, however, you've already shared with us that there are evidence-based services, evidence-based principles that have been proven to reduce recidivism. But looking at the chart, we have numbers, but it doesn't give us any idea of what programs were in place in those years that may have had an effect or not on recidivism. You follow what I'm saying? So it's kind of an incomplete picture.
Madam Chair, you are absolutely correct in regards to the chart, and what we have tracked as a statutory requirement for recidivism is, in fact, these numbers. I believe that the spirit and the intent of this body's passage of Senate Bill 267 was to do exactly what it is that you have pointed out, and that is to tie program success, and in juvenile justice, that would be the reduction of recidivism with evidence-based or research-based practices. And as Ms. Rios described how the Youth Authority is moving forward in doing that, it is the outcome. We will have data that will track a youth back and show what programs they have been in with a similar profile, and will help us do more of what works in the reduction of recidivism and to put less of our resources in that which proves not to work in terms of reducing recidivism.
Representative Hannah.
Madam Chair, thank you. Again, I know we could chew these numbers up, but there's a lot of data here and it might not be appropriate, but if you're talking about evidence-based outcomes and how this works, is there a link to the term of sentence to recidivism? In other words, if you get a juvenile offender and you track everybody that got committed to a facility for 120 days or less, do they have a higher recidivism rate than the group that spends 36 months or more? Or is there any breakdown like that would indicate if you're going to put somebody in the facility, there's some period of time where it really bangs home the idea you did something wrong here and you're going to pay the price for it? Or is there a period of time that says, I went for a little while, it wasn't any big deal, and I'm back in the system?
Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, I think that's a very good question, because, in fact, through the development of individual case plans, that is the intent and the goal, to have youth accomplish in our secure facilities and then accomplish in our transitional programs that which requires that level of custody, and then reentry plans that continue their programs once they return to the communities to maximize the use of the state's resource in that regard. And I think that is the spirit of evidence-based practice and cost-effective programs is, in fact, not to do too little and not to do too much, because both of those can cost additional funds.
Can I follow up, please?
Mm-hmm.
And then again, I wonder, too, we had the opportunity to see the school program at McLaren, which by the way was impressive as all get out, and you got the feeling that the accomplishment gained by leaving with the high school diploma was a major factor. Not only did the staff take pride in it, but you know, the few people that we had contact with did. Do they have a lower recidivism rate? I guess what I'm saying is I'd like to see more data around those programs that you do that from a novice view look good, seem like they would have a major impact, and in reality, if we measured their rate of recidivism against someone who didn't complete that program or wasn't there long enough to get that, and we're sitting here deciding where do we put funding? Do we replace the tents or do we spend more money on the school? I mean, those are sort of the issues that I think we've got to get at the crux of. And maybe you have to do both, but we got to get to that.
And Madam Chair, Representative Hannah, I think that you absolutely get it, because that is, in fact, what the two parallel tracks that we must address. And there is no question that a young person is better equipped when they return to the community with a high school diploma, from the standpoint that they have completed that one passage in their life, and they can either look at secondary education or they can look at employment or some kind of vocational training. Part of what the case plan and these multidisciplinary team reviews are designed to determine and measure is at what point do the external controls become less necessary, and the youth has internalized that structure and would be able to continue, such as attending a public high school, as they were not able to do perhaps prior to commitment, and the cost of housing that young person then is saved. So those are some of the challenges, but the direction that we have moved as an agency around evidence-based programs and also coupled with the Juvenile Justice Information System, I think that you will increasingly be able to see data that ties those together. And we will do some quick runs and see if we can tie some of that before the conclusion of these hearings and provide you some more data linking programs and outcomes with individual youth.
Great. Thank you.
Very good. Just doing a little time check here. We're going to need to pick up the pace a bit, members and Mr. Jester, if we are to make it through the bulk of our agenda today. So. Let
me do that, Madam Chair. On page 23, last legislative session, we were asked to develop a comparable recidivism measure to that which was used by DOC. And we did that by using the Juvenile Justice Information System and Department of Corrections Information System. We have looked at criminal activity for youth that are both on probation and have been released from a youth correctional facility, and we have looked at adjudication of a felony as the event, as opposed to a referral. It is now an adjudication or a court process on a felony law violation, and we have tracked that the same way that DOC does with their cohort. And you will see in the chart at the bottom, for youth that are on parole, these are youth coming out of a youth correctional facility. The event that starts the clock is their reentry in the community. 12 months out for 2001, we have a 12.6% are adjudicated on new felony. 24 months out, that rises to 25%, and 36 months out, it's 35.4%. 2002 and 2003 data obviously do not have the full 12, 24, 36 months, but you can see that these numbers are also going down, we believe, with the focus on evidence-based programming and doing what works, that we will continue to impact in this area for youth leaving youth correctional facilities. The bottom part of the chart will show you youth on probation, and again, the clock is starting when they first come into our custody for probation, and then we're tracking 1 year out from that period of time. We're also looking for a felony adjudication, and going back to 2001, you will see that 12 months out we're 12%, 24 months out we're 20%, 36 months out we're about 26%, excuse me. These numbers are also improving, and they are less than those for youth that are leaving youth correctional facilities, which is what we would expect to happen, because this group of youth have less risk when they start our programs.
Senator Devlin's going to help us pick up the pace by asking his question.
Yeah. I just wanted to say I don't want you to get into any trouble with the Corrections Division, but I think actually your presentation of this and the data in this form actually is better than what they presented us in terms of recidivism issues, in terms of particularly close custody, than what we saw from the Corrections Division.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin, and Max Williams, if you're listening.
I'm sure he is.
Thank you very much. turning to page 24 and 25, OIA measures that have been selected for outcomes have been selected to focus on reducing risk for committing new crimes through effective reformation intervention. And we are going to go through these performance measures in each of the following sections that we present for you, and then we will wrap those up in our summary. So with the chair's permission, at this time I would ask Brian Florp to come forward, and he will be talking to you about our facility programs if there's no questions.
Very good. And members, I would just ask you to reflect on the performance measures on page 24, knowing that we do want to spend a good deal of time on these. Good afternoon, Mr. Florp.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Brian Florp. I'm the Assistant Director at the Oregon Youth Authority, responsible for facility operations, and I will be taking you through the facility section of the agency budget presentation this afternoon. As we proceed through the section, the information will focus on our closed custody system of 10 facilities. Madam Chair, with your permission, if I might, I would like to assure Representative Hanna that youth in our secure facilities do not have access to drugs and alcohol, and that the youth in our transition programs who work in a supervised status in the community, there is a possibility of exposure, but we're vigilant in supervising the youth and checking for contraband when they return.
I'm glad to hear that.
I would start with the bottom half of page 41 in the budget document, and as Director Jester discussed in the overview, offenders in our facilities are there under two different legal status. The first is a juvenile commitment from juvenile court. The second are transfers from the Department of Corrections, and that's detailed there on page 41. Before I leave this section or this page, I would also point out that the pie chart at the top of the page reflects a proportion of Oregon Youth Authority's budget that is devoted to facility operations. That's 48% of our total fund budget. On page 42, we'll speak a little bit about the demographic characteristics of the youth that are in the facilities. And Director Jester did speak about these same demographics in relation to our entire population in the Youth Authority. I just wanted to point out a couple of issues that are unique to the characteristics of the youth in the facilities. I would start by saying that the proportion of sex offenders is much higher in our facility population than it is in our communities. Further, that our proportions of minority youth between the facilities and our community programs are nearly identical, with the exception of African American youth. And African American youth are twice as likely to be in one of our facilities than in a community program. Proportion of female youth is significantly lower in the facilities than in the community. And finally, our age range in the facilities. We have much older youth in the facilities than we do participating in our community programs.
I'm going to stop you just for a moment.
Sure.
Representative Hanna, is that your shadow?
That is one of the shadows from Gilkey Middle School in Portland.
Would you like her to join us so she can get a bird's eye view of...
She is very welcome to do that at your pleasure,
thanks,
Madam Chair, but I'm not sure if she wants to be that close. Would you like to come up and sit at the dais up here?
Sure.
It's a great experience.
Madam Chair.
It's a great chance.
Representative Hanson.
And I, too, have a shadow.
Oh, yeah. Well, please.
That is. Well, I can have bookends here.
You can be
here.
Surrounded.
Yeah,
come
up. Take a seat.
That is one of the big green chairs.
Yeah.
Yes.
I've never sat in one. And contrary to what Representative Hanson says, I don't fight, so...
Would you like to tell us your name and how old you are?
That was
okay. I'm Ella Zawi. I'm 13, and I'm an eighth grader at Doki Middle School.
And I'm Moira McKay, and I'm 13, and I go to Doki Middle School, eighth grade.
Well, welcome. And Senator Devlin?
Yes. None of the presenters this morning on the floor, nor the parties here, have identified where Gilkey Middle School is. where is Gilkey Middle School?
In Portland.
Okay.
It's over by Forest Heights in Northwest Portland.
It's probably your district.
No, it's not. No, it's not.
Okay. Madam Chair, with your indulgence, girls, would you tell us a little bit about the language program, just briefly, because it's really a special school, and it's great that they're here and having this experience.
There's also a lower school, so there's a middle school and the lower school. The lower school specializes in Spanish language full immersion program, and in the middle school, they have Spanish, German, and French beginning language programs as well as the French full immersion language program.
We also have German and Spanish full immersion programs, but there's not as many, and they are closing the programs down, but the people that have been in them are graduating before.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the international track, which is only in beginning language, and they aren't completely fluent in another language.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much for sharing that information with us. And please do get very comfortable in those chairs, because we don't have enough women serving in the legislature in the state of Oregon. So claim your seats.
Definitely.
Get used to it.
Very good. Please continue, Mr. Flora.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will expect difficult questions from this side of the dais. I would ask you to turn to page 43 in your book, and I would point out that in the Youth Authority, we have two levels of custody, the most secure being youth correctional facilities. You can see that it makes up the bulk of our facility capacity at 725 beds. The youth correctional facilities do provide that highest level of security and reformation service, and the youth there are generally housed in living units of 25 youth. We use a comprehensive risk assessment that Ms. Rios talked about earlier to help us build a case plan, and the reformation supportive services are provided by not only our own employees, but also by contracted folk. And then at the middle section there on page 43, you can see the list of the six youth correction facilities in our system and the primary type of youth that they serve. On page 44, discussion about our transition programs. You see we have 125 beds in our transition program array. These programs provide that bridge between youth correction facilities and placement in the community for the youth. The programs focus on continued reformation service, but primarily on educational and vocational skill building for the youth as they prepare to return back to the community. Youth do work on supervised work crews. They are employed by local businesses, and community service is a big part of what we do out there. The activities are designed to instill that work ethic and accountability. And there at the top third of the page, you'll see the list of the four programs that we operate in the transition category.
And if I recall, you don't have enough capacity in your transition programs?
Transition is very, very important, Madam Chair, and I think what we find is that they're always in demand.
Please continue.
Thank you.
Representative Hansen.
Thank you. What transition services are available for Major 11 offenders when they leave?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, through working agreement with the Department of Corrections, we are able to utilize some of these program activities in these sites to serve DOC inmates. We, of course, are very, very careful about security and supervision in light of their status, but they can go out and access some of the vocational and educational opportunities in our transition program. Now, one of the difficulties we have is our parole and probation staff do not interact with the DOC inmates, so it really falls back to our facility staff then to do some of the transition planning, and then as they near the end of their sentence, we contact community corrections and begin that handoff.
But, okay, for say, a 16-year-old that's serving a 70-month sentence, so they'd be leaving it, say, before age 22,
Do they get housing allowances or transitional parole services after they leave, or when they complete their sentence, are they just out of the system?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, my belief is most of the DOC inmates we serve do have the opportunity for post-prison supervision and some assistance from community corrections.
Thank you.
On page 45 of the document, you'll see a map that shows the location of the 10 facilities in our close custody system. You can see that they are distributed around the state. As we deliver reformation services in facilities, Ms. Rios gave a very good explanation of the process that we use to deliver those services. Again, those four steps are: we start with assessment, then we go to case plan development for each youth, then we implement a service delivery program based on the case plan, and then finally we do evaluation and monitoring of the youth's progress and make adjustments as necessary. When youth enter a facility, whether through commitment or through a revocation, we apply the Oregon Risk Needs Assessment. It's either the first application for a new commitment or an update for a youth that's been with us for some time. And that assessment drives the development of a plan of services that we would provide in the facilities. And as you also heard, we are beginning the transition from paper case plans into JGIS, which has proven just an extremely valuable transition. It allows all those who have interaction and play in a use case plan to access that information and provide information to that team, that multidisciplinary team. As we start to talk about delivering those services, again, they're designed to reduce criminal and antisocial thoughts and behaviors. We provide a variety of service and educational programs and work experience in the facilities. And there in the middle of the page on 46, you can see an example of what some of those reformation activities would be. We have, of course, focused on implementing evidence-based programs, as you've heard already in the presentation, and our curriculums are moving in the direction of cognitive behavioral programming and, again, focusing on those criminogenic risk factors. I would point out, too, that educational and vocational programs in our facilities are provided through contract with local school districts or education service districts by the Oregon Department of Education.
Could you speak to the programs provided by education service districts?
Madam Chair, certainly. In each of the facilities, there are educational and vocational services provided, and I believe in all of the facilities currently, that is done by an ESD that is contracted with the Department of Education. They run accredited high school classes, they provide vocational training opportunities, and depending upon the size and the focus of facilities, those vocational opportunities can be varied and quite rich, actually. And in the transition programs, we focus on preparing that youth for return to the community, whether that be reengaging in their local high school or heading toward an employment track.
Have you been following, has the department been following the discussions in the Education and Workforce Committee around, on the Senate side, around consolidation of education service districts?
Madam Chair, we are aware of those discussions.
Are you a participant in conversations focused on proposals for downsizing, reconfiguring ESDs so that your interests are being taken into consideration?
Madam Chair, I would let Director Jester speak to the overall system approach. From facilities perspective, we enjoy a very strong relationship with the ESDs that we are involved with, and I think the consolidation may impact the number and some of those ESDs, so we certainly have concerns.
Okay. We'll wait to hear later from Mr. Jester about that, and frankly, want to be aware of any concerns you have about the ESD proposal or proposals that are being floated out there as they relate to your ability to deliver services to your population. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would ask that you turn to page 47. I'd like to talk a little bit about how we work to maintain quality and continue to improve our facility programs. We have several key processes that are focusing on continued program development and improvement in facilities. As has been discussed earlier in the presentation, we are embarking on a plan to regularly review our facilities using the correctional program assessment inventory, and we have completed an initial review of each facility using that instrument. And from those reports, we've developed a plan to implement evidence-based programming and improve our effectiveness in those programs. And we plan to begin reassessment of those programs in 2005. So we're looking forward to seeing where we've made gains and where we still have work to do. Since 1998, all of OA's youth correctional facilities participated in a national project called Performance-Based Standards. Performance-Based Standards measures specific standards and accomplishments that are indicators of performance and speak to conditions of confinement within the facilities. That project has identified seven key and interrelated areas of facility operation, and there on the bottom half of page 47, you will see those seven areas and a list of goals for each of those areas. In each of those areas, addressing the goals are a set of outcome measures and standards, and we certainly have implemented in each of our facilities efforts to track those particular outcome measures. When we see areas of concern, we work to develop a plan of improvement, and then we reassess to see how our progress is happening. At the top of page 48, there is also in each facility a regular quality assurance component. We are regularly reviewing our facilities for safety and security issues. There are quality assurance teams established at each facility, and they interact with the OIA program office in assuring that we are consistent in our approaches and that we communicate where we've made gains or have developed efficiencies. The next section in the facility presentation deals with the closed custody demand forecast. Madam Chair, members of the committee, with your permission, I would like to defer this section, skip over it. We expect Sue Porter from the Office of Economic Analysis to come in a little later in the afternoon and present a summary of this material.
Very good.
Thank you.
Representative Wilson.
Madam Chair, you finished page 48. That's part of yours or not?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, Representative Wisdom. Page 48 deals with the demand forecast, and Sue Porter will come in and take you through that section.
Thank you.
On page 49 is another copy of the OI organizational chart. You've seen it earlier in the document. Highlighted on this page is the section related to facility services and our FTE of approximately 800, representing about 77% of the OI workforce. On page 50, I'd like to spend a few moments and talk about key measures of agency performance as they relate to facilities. Currently, these key measures are based on the performance-based standards that we've just finished discussing. What we've done is chosen eight key measures from the performance-based standards that speak to issues relating to safety and security, how we provide our reformation services within those facilities. These eight measures are just eight of 111 that we track regularly in the facilities. PBS has served as our foundation for system improvement for some time, but as discussed, we are moving toward a more robust, system of performance measurement, and we plan to work toward additional measures of intermediate and high-level outcome as we continue to move forward. Chair Gordy, with your permission, I'd then walk through the eight facility performance measures.
Please.
Okay. On the bottom of page 50, the first we track is completed escapes, walkaways, or AWOLs from our facility campuses.
And these are a reflection of the measures back on page 24.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I'm hearing yes from the back chair. Mm-hmm. On page 51, we also track injuries.
Representative Hanna.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Explain to us the thousandths of a percent decimal there for OIA. How did it get there? We were zeros ahead of that, and then we went to some number.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, what the chart describes is a rate that is used by the National Performance-Based Standards Project to allow for comparison between facilities of different sizes. And the rate reflects the number of runaways per 100 person days or 100 days of confinement in each facility. And so what this chart shows for OIA is in 2003 and 2004, there were three youth who escaped. The difference in the chart is because our population decreased, which made the rate a little higher, but it reflects three youth who ran. And in all three cases, during these sample months, those youth were from transition programs, from our Corvallis House and Riverbend community transition programs.
Thank you.
Again, on 51, we track injuries to youth, and again, use the same rate calculation, number of injuries per 100 person days of confinement. Of course, our goal is to have injury reduction, but I would point out to the committee that this measure does target any form of injury, whether that be from youth participating in sports or involved in some kind of work activity or just an accidental slip on campus.
What is our experience to date?
Why are we doing that?
With this particular performance measure, what are you experiencing around injuries?
Chair Gordley, our rate of injury is lower than the average for facilities participating at a national level in this project. I think what we find is the majority of the injuries that we are experiencing currently do deal with just kind of normal routine at facilities. We certainly do have occasional youth injury from, you know, intervention with staff, but that's not the bulk of the statistic.
Would you please unpack that for us with some more detail? What type of injuries are we talking about? How are the injuries caused?
Sure.
How are the injuries reported, and where?
Sure. Chair Gordy, again, the injuries described in this particular performance measure reflect the full range of physical injury that can occur to a youth in a secure setting. So they range from the minor sprains from participating in a physical education class, to an injury in the woodworking shop, through injuries that occur during a physical intervention with staff. We track those injuries through the use of an incident report. Each one is documented. It is kept in the use file. Medical attention is provided whenever there's an injury documented, and that attention is appropriate. And again, we track them on a regular basis, and that information is provided to medical staff and to administration of each facility.
And the per 100 person days, how did you arrive at per 100 days? What is that?
Chair Gordy, the rates are rates that were established by the national project, and the intent is so that we can compare a small facility of 25 youth with a facility size of McLaren and make a comparison about the rate of injury versus just the raw number.
Okay. Representative Hanna.
Madam Chair, thank you. I guess I can't find the significance of measuring accidental rates of injury within the same bundle as injury with combining it with injuries that may be from connection with security staff and or injuries that might be from the case of between two inmates. And I would like to recommend that as we go through these measurements, we consider making an adjustment to that,
mm-hmm.
that just packing those all together doesn't have relevance.
I agree with you.
Chair Gordley, Representative Hanna, the injuries that relate to physical intervention, we do certainly track, and they are addressed in a different manner. Our response in this particular key performance measure is so that we stay aligned with the national project, and I think the goal of this measure is to track overall safety in the facility. It doesn't speak to the issue you described, and certainly we do, you know, track that as well in a separate way.
Well, we're going to want to make some adjustments, is what you're hearing.
Absolutely.
Okay.
The third performance measure is the bottom page 51. It speaks to suicidal behavior with injury to youth, again, for 100 person days using that same rate calculation. And in this particular performance measure, I would point out, you'll see the line that spikes up. It's not a line of actual injuries. That is our target that we've established as an agency. I would like to explain the reason the target has been raised as it has. The National Project has readjusted the definition of suicidal behavior with injury to include any self-injurious kind of self-harm behavior. A national panel chaired by Lindsay Hayes, a national expert on youth suicide, has pointed out to us and to all youth correction agencies that any self-harm behavior is a precursor and a warning sign for potential suicidality. So the measure was changed to reflect that. We've broadened the definition of what we track in this particular performance measure.
I'm thinking about that 100 days. And I'm not quite sure what I want to ask about it, but I'm mulling over why it isn't a shorter period of time, I guess. That would be one question.
Chair Gordley, it's a difficult rate to explain and have make sense. In a facility the size of McLaren, if there are 300 youth, then that's 300 days of confinement for each calendar day. And for a smaller facility, like a 25-bed transition program, it would then take four calendar days, before you get to that 100 days of confinement. The goal of adjusting it by a rate is, again, so you can get a kind of a comparison between facilities of disproportionate size. But I think it's as important to track the raw numbers and understand in each facility, you know, kind of what we're dealing with as far as number of occurrence.
Well, let's flag this one, too, and we'll come back to it in the next phase.
On page 52, performance measure 4 addresses the percent of youth confined for more than 60 days whose records indicate that they receive the education programming prescribed by their individual treatment plan. So here what we are doing is reviewing the case plan for each youth, and where educational activity is called for in that case plan, we're tracking to see that it is in fact delivered. And we certainly work in partnership with our contractors, with the ESDs, to meet this performance measure. Performance measure 5, bottom page 52, deals with percent of youth presented for admission who had a complete intake screening by trained and qualified staff. We've spoken earlier in the presentation about the importance of assessment and screening, and I would point out that you see early on our results were very high. In 2003, they seemed to dip down. This dip is due to the fact that we've increased our requirements for screening and assessment. We're asking for a higher number and a more intense nature of assessment and screening for each youth. So staff are working their way back up through training to achieve our goal of 100%.
And we also need to understand why you would have a situation where you did not have a complete intake screening by a trained and qualified staff.
Chair Gordley, I think part of that dip again is due to the fact that as we work to train all staff who are involved in providing intake services and we distribute additional intake requirements, the files don't reflect in every case that all screenings were completed. And so we're working to return that measure to 100% compliance.
So the issue is training?
Partly training. Part of the fact that we've implemented new tools.
Ms. Baker?
To clarify in my own mind, is it an all or nothing measure? I mean, if you've got 95% of intake screening completed, it scores a zero for this purpose?
Yes, Chair Baker, Chair Gordley, Staff Baker. The answer is yes, it has to be completed to get credit in our assessment. But the other issue is more of a tracking issue, that as we change requirement, when we sample files, what we get are youth who were screened or admitted prior to the change in requirement, so those particular screenings are not present, and we expect that the curve will again increase as we kind of move further into the implementation.
Chair. Representative Lisbon.
Mm-hmm. It's even alarming that the national average, they're looking at a 69% goal. I don't understand that, which, you know, we're using as our... This one seems to be pub... You know, we need to tell the U.S. or national, they need to do something different here. I think at least if you're screening someone in, you maybe need to identify the critical. I mean, this gives the impression that we're not doing a good job of bringing them in and being sure that they're looked after or in the right treatment program. So at least maybe you need to, you know, maybe you need to say that processing a man only involves these critical things, and it gets, because it gives a false impression that we're putting them in the system and we don't really have a plan for helping them.
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnett, I'm confident that in our intake units, screenings are being completed, all the screenings we require. And I think what we find as we look at this comparison in the national standard project is we pull files that were released during that particular sample period. So they date back further than the implementation of some of the new screenings, and we get a mismatch in what it is that we're looking for versus what we required some time back. And again, that's going to flatten out quickly over time, but it did show a dip in our statistics.
Well, let me ask the question this way. In 2004, did every youth presented for admission receive a complete intake and screening?
Madam Chair, I would answer yes to that. And again, I think the disparity is because...
Mr. Jester is saying no, well, right behind you. You might want to confer. Come on up.
Madam Chair, again, I think as we review our intake processes, it is a routine process, and you do receive the screenings that we currently mandate. In checking our data for this particular project, we pull a sample of files of youth who left the facility during that target period, and there is a disparity in what we look for versus what we currently require. That explains part of this. Certainly, there's always the case where a particular inventory may have been missed. I think that's a very small minority of the cases we're dealing with.
Mr. Jester, you want to swing that microphone around and hear your thoughts?
Madam Chair, I would agree with Mr. Florek's last statement. I think that there are some youth that undoubtedly have not had the 100% of all the screening assessment done. And although that is our goal and target, I don't believe that that is probably fully the case. Some youth actually leave the facility prior to the completion of those assessments, and I think that may also be reflected in this data, that when the court commits a youth, they come in the front door, that assessment process is begun where youth visited the tents at McLaren, and they begin that process. There is the possibility that a county could then send in another youth, be at or over their cap, and remove the one before the completion of the assessment.
The screening and assessment is supposed to take place within what period of time again? Is that 30 days?
Madam Chair, the screening does take place within the first 30 days of admission.
Senator Devlin?
Without pointing out the obvious, everyone's looking at the same performance measure I am, the fifth performance measure, I'm looking at that. You had very high performance in these areas up to about, well, you was down a little bit, but then you improved right back up in 2001. And I don't know if your criteria changed or something, but 2001 is when we started taking a lot of resources away from you. So I don't know if there's any direct correlation between the decline in this performance measure and us taking away resources. I'm just trying to say the odds.
Madam Chair, Senator Devlin.
Well, I think you're reversing the bars. The decrease in resources is reflected starting in 2003.
Oh, actually, 2002. In the special sessions is when we started cutting OYA.
Well, we didn't cut the national average.
Right.
No.
Right.
No, I can't. Yeah. I can't change the national average, but
it's something strange.
Representative Hansen.
Well, a concern of mine that you've raised now is because of cap management, do we have youth coming into the system that are staying for a very, very short time?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, there are a small number of youth who stay for a short period of time. When you say short, I mean very short.
I mean
less than 30 days.
Less than 30 days. Madam Chair, the other factor that plays in this screening data element is some of the failure to get credit reflects not that the screening wasn't done, but that it didn't necessarily hit the timeline. We have certain screenings that we require happen within hours of intake. Physical health screen has to be completed by a medical personnel within an hour of intake. So if the youth is in our receiving area and we're supervising that youth, there are cases where the nurse can't get to that youth within the prescribed timeline. We certainly complete the screening and the youth is supervised and safe during that time, but we miss the mark as far as the national standard and the goal that we set. So some of the failure to achieve 100% deals with timelines, not the fact that the screening wasn't completed.
Further questions? Representative Hanna.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. That just brings up a point, and it's why we're having these discussions about the performance measures in general, just to sort of chew on them a little bit. But if that's the case, and from what I think I understand, virtually everybody coming in is getting the assessment. And that might be a good measure. Are they getting the assessment or not? The other thing is there might be a timeline that you're not meeting on some or parts of the assessment. And, you know, you hate to create new measures, but you know, I'd feel badly if this committee walked away saying we're not sure they're getting the assessment done. That, to me, is a critical issue. If you're getting the whole assessment done, but you're missing a mark or part of a mark on one of them, that'd be another issue. And we might try to decide what's critical about that measurement as we move forward.
Madam Chair, with your permission, I would like to consult with the folks who do the data collection. My belief is that a good share of the incomplete marks deal with timelines and not the fact the screenings are not completed, and I would bring that information back to the committee.
That would be very helpful. I think what we're struggling with here is the definition of complete as it is used in this performance measure.
Absolutely.
The word complete. Okay. Moving on to Performance Measure 6.
Madam Chair, Performance Measure 6 states the percentage of youth confined for more than 30 days whose records indicate a written individual treatment plan. I think, again, we have increasing set of high standards on what we define as an individual treatment plan, but currently all youth are being assessed, and we are developing a case plan for each youth in the facility system. Performance Measure 7 deals with percentage of youth confined for more than 60 days with a finalized written aftercare plan prior to 30 days from their release date. In this particular measure, we are improving in this regard. I think we are challenged by the continual movement of youth from the facility system to the community, but our parole officers and our treatment staff at the facilities are continually working to improve this measure so that each youth will have a written transition plan prior to release.
And that's critical. It would be directly related to the recidivism issue. So you'd want that to be 100%.
Madam Chair, I absolutely agree.
Speak to us about what the challenges are in getting to that 100%.
Madam Chair, part of the challenges relate, again, to the volume of youth and the, in some cases, short windows of time that we have to prepare and complete a transition decision and placement. So, again, part of what we talk about is the timeline of this measure. If the transition plan isn't completed 30 days prior to release, then we don't take credit in this particular national outcome measure. It doesn't mean that that youth didn't have a written transition plan at point of release. It may not have been completed 30 days prior to that.
Madam Chair.
Representative.
I wondered, like, if we get down to more details, like even on this one, we could have a performance measure 7A that says every youth got a plan when he was released back into the community. Again, looking at protecting the public or making sure the public knows that we didn't let that youth go without some plan. So, you know, work the national one, but have a 7A that, you know, is for our, make us feel good and make the community feel good, and if you're doing it, because it...
Madam Chair, Representative Wisnant, thank you. That's an excellent suggestion. On page 54, performance measure 8, it is the percentage of youth who refer to at least one community-based service as outlined in their aftercare treatment plan, and this referral is intended in the outcome measure to take place prior to the release. What it speaks to is our desire to begin that transition activity and engage with community providers prior to the youth leaving the facility. It's a goal and a tenet that we believe is critical, and our numbers continue to improve in that regard.
Representative Hansen.
When you're going back to the performance measure 6, does that written individual treatment plan also include the education plan for your special ed kids?
Chair Gordley, Representative Hansen, the individual treatment plan does include a component on the education domain in that youth reformation. It doesn't speak to the IEP, that is the process we've contracted and deferred to our education providers in the school setting. So to follow up, there would be, for those youth special ed and in need of an IEP, a separate IEP that is kept in the education plan our contractor has, not a part of this individual case plan we're referencing here.
Says you must have at least one.
But the education piece, would that not be captured in performance measure 5 as a part of the intake screening and assessment of needs?
Madam Chair, I would answer no, that the screenings we completed intake, this performance measure doesn't reflect the screenings that are done as part of the assessment for special ed and the development of an IEP. That's done in the schools that we, again, contract for. There is, in our case plan, an education domain where we track information and kind of relevant activities that our MDT needs to be aware of, but there is also an IEP kept for those eligible youths apart from our case plan.
So then, would it be captured in performance measure 4?
Madam Chair, again, I would answer that it would not. This set of performance measures deals with the OIA case plan and what we track, the activities that relate to, you know, the overall provision of reformation services, and there's a separate education plan that is kept by our provider.
Even separate from performance measure 4, which is also related to education programming.
That's correct.
That's confusing.
It is.
We'll want to come back to this one as well to understand fully how you're doing performance measures on the special ed and the whole education component that is provided by contractors.
Absolutely.
Okay. Representative Hansen?
Well, very quickly, Hannah? What I think is pretty important about that, our regional overview said 64% of your kids are special ed. Those plans are pretty complicated, pretty in-depth. I'm concerned in terms of the amount of energy we're putting in to that level of planning on kids that are going to be there for a very short time. The other one is... I'm also would like information on whether those plans leave with the kids. If the kids are going on to another education system when they leave, if that's transferable, and if there's a continuation of the plan, maybe modified or whatever, but how that fits considering it impacts 64% of your kids, it becomes a big deal.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, the education plans developed are communicated with receiving schools, and there is a transfer of records from our facilities to the school that the youth will attend in the community.
Please continue.
Madam Chair, that concludes.
Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Are these the entire group of performance measures? Is this?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, these eight reflect the key performance measures chosen for the Progress Board set of requirements, but we do track 111 different outcome measures in this particular performance-based standards project that relate to conditions of confinement and delivery of reformation services. We also track outcome measures outside of that process that are important for the operation of each facility.
Follow up, please.
Mm-hmm.
As an example, and again, not to be critical, but only to continue the discussion of for this body to be, if it's this body using these eight items to measure your performance, I would not feel comfortable. Percent of youth referred to at least one community-based service as outlined in an aftercare treatment plan. In terms of relevance to your performance for what you did towards their reformation to return, it just says you aimed them at somebody on the way out the door. I don't think it's truly a measure of what you did with them while they were there. I would much rather see a measure of recidivism rate. I'd much rather see a measure of how many of them that you had long enough to go through a school program that didn't have a GED or a high school diploma ended up and had one when they left. I mean, I think if we're going to measure this and we're going to pick 8 or 10 marks, let's pick 8 or 10, again, and this is a committee, but, I mean, things that I would look at and say, you made a difference in their life while they were there, not who did I point them at when they were leaving. I'm just not sure that's the kind of thing that I would feel comfortable walking away from this committee saying, boy, I feel really good that we're on the mark here.
Madam Chair, Representative Hanna, I absolutely agree, and we continue to evolve our performance measures, and currently our intent is to work toward the utilization of the automated case plan, track competencies of the youth as they achieve them, as they relate to their goals, and then the process steps that you describe are absolutely critical, and we track those. They are just not a part of our current AP measure of performance.
Okay. Thank you.
You're reading my mind. Representative Hanna has put his finger on something very critical. It would be helpful to see the other performance measures, the 100 or so.
Madam Chair, I'd be happy to provide the entire set of standards
with
and the outcome measures we track.
Because what strikes me about performance measure 8 is that, you know, depending on the content of the aftercare treatment plan, and what community-based services are outlined, 3 or 30, you know, which one, no one, could be a real critical choice. But this doesn't really tell us anything about content and quality of the choices and decision-making and who makes those decisions and all of that.
I agree, and I agree with the comments from Representative Hanna. And again, as we move into compliance with 267 and the evidence-based approach, we're looking to be compliant with principles of effective intervention, and that, you know, is measured in ways that clearly exceed these eight performance measures.
Mm-hmm. How quickly can you provide the other performance measures to us?
Madam Chair, I can have them by the end of the day, if you like, or tomorrow when we present.
Oh, very good. Very good. Please continue.
This concludes my portion of the presentation.
All right. Thank you very much for being with us this afternoon. Capital budgets?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, at this time, with your permission, I would like to invite Sue Porter up to the table to talk about the demand forecast, and this relates back to a piece in the facility section that Mr. Florup.
Mr. Jester, would you like to spend the rest of the time, the remaining 16 minutes, on the juvenile population demand forecast and then pick up with capital budgets?
Madam Chair, I think that would be an excellent plan.
All right.
members, the page 48 of the document you have in front of you is the page on the demand forecast.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Suzanne Porter with the Office of Economic Analysis, and with me is Dave Beck. He's our deputy state economist, and we're here today in 15 minutes to brief you on closed custody forecasting. We've recently changed how we do that, and so we're going to try and explain why we did that and what it is that we changed. We've been doing these forecasts since 1998, and we look at the population in terms of three groups: the adult court population, the people that are convicted in adult court. They're under the legal custody of the Department of Corrections, but they're in the physical custody of the Youth Authority. The second group is the public safety reserve. Those are the juveniles with the serious first-degree person-to-person crimes that are defined in an administrative rule. And then finally, the discretionary bed allocation. And the discretionary bed allocation is where we have changed the forecast most. We could arguably say those first two groups are non-discretionary, and at least they have the first crack at the beds that are available. Whatever's left goes to the discretionary bed allocation. Now, in the old days, we used to say we're going to use current practice and policies and apply them to future conditions, and that's how we're going to get the forecast. And since 2001, when the Youth Authority's budget was started to be reduced and current practices and policies changed, you know, to accommodate the smaller discretionary bed allocation, what happened is we were just forecasting forward, just reflecting the funding level. It wasn't really providing any useful information. And that became abundantly clear in 2003 when the youth correctional facilities closed. It made no sense to continue on forecasting the way that we were. It wasn't providing anyone any useful information. So in talking with people that use our forecast, Youth Authority, Legislative Fiscal Budget Management, and the Juvenile Department directors, everybody was interested in seeing if we could forecast demand for the discretionary bed allocation or DBA. And we got together an ad hoc group in 2003, and the first order of business was to get data. And we had from Juvenile Justice Information System, the JGIS people, they were able to give us, in the fall, it took them all summer, they compiled a file that had all delinquency referrals with their by the most serious allegation, with the most restrictive disposition to date. And this file had, like, it's got between 250 and 300,000 records in it. And this was the key piece that allowed us to forecast for demand. It also gave us the ability to improve our forecasting for those other two non-discretionary groups. And the premise that we were working on is if there's unmet demand in the community for discretionary beds, we should find out in the community youth with similar delinquency characteristics as the kids who did go to the DBA. And using the advice from this ad hoc committee, we looked at the period 1996 to 2002. That was a period of increase and decrease, so we wouldn't be picking a high point. We're looking for average practice. And during that time, there was about 90,000 kids that were referred at least once. About 3% of them went to the discretionary bed allocation. And that group that did go to the DBA, we ended up calling them the mirror population. Those are the people, those characteristics we're trying to reflect.
So we use this model to help us analyze the data. It's called a binary choice model, and I'll spare you all the details, but we divide the kids into two groups. They went or they didn't go. And we have all of their delinquency characteristics as far as how many times they've been referred, what were they referred for, when were they first referred, how old are they in their last referral. And this model is able to, you know, go through all that data and come up with a set of characteristics that explain why one kid went and another one didn't. And it also makes an equation for each kid. And when that equation is solved, each kid has a score ranging from 0 to 1. One, you know, if it was a perfect model, every kid that went to the youth authority would have a score of 1. And we were able to predict 80% of the kids that went to the youth authority and 97% of the ones that didn't go. And there's a box on my testimony on page 2. Those are the characteristics that were most helpful in determining who went. And this ad hoc committee we had, they were able to, before we even saw the data, told us what we would probably see. And they were right. I mean, they told us it would be the age at first referral, they would be younger. The number of referrals, the severity, and their current age. And if you look at those characteristics, they all center around, the age and the number and severity of referrals.
And what group forecasted that this is what you would see?
We had an ad hoc committee that we got together. The core of it was our juvenile corrections forecast committee that helps us, and we invited other people in to advise us. So after we have this prediction equation, our next step is to set a critical score. There was a new executive order written, and it said that our advisory committee is supposed to define what demand for discretionary beds is. And we could see that this critical score would be the key to that. Every kid has a score. But where we set that is, it's a judgment call. And rather than, the committee did not want to sit around and decide is it should be 0.68 or 0.51. So what they did is made some criteria that we could use to set the score. Now we had, again, that mirror population. Then we had people that stay out in the community but are going to have the same characteristics as that mirror. They're called scorers. Together, that group's called the total demand population. And the first criterion they gave us was that the average score for this total demand population should be the same as for the mirror population. In other words, we're not going to set the bar so low that lots and lots of less serious kids end up being demand. Then we could be accused of, you know, inflating the numbers to try and advocate for more space. So by holding the mean score to the same as those people who did go, we tried to, you know, eliminate that perception. And the second criterion was that the age distribution for this total demand population should be similar to the mirror population. In other words, we don't want 10 times more 12-year-olds becoming the demand that actually went. That doesn't make sense. A kid's age is a real important determinant in placement. Generally speaking, two kids with the same criminal history and offense, one's 12 and one's 16, the 12-year-old is less likely to be placed in the discretionary bed allocation. So those, for the two forecasts we've completed and the third one we're working on now, those criteria have served us well so far.
The criteria, how do they take into account gender, or is gender a factor?
Madam Chair, no. It's in the data, but it did not wind up being one of the critical factors. What we wind up with is 5 or 6 critical scores for each age cohort, 12 through 17. Once we've done that, we've got a critical score. It's relatively simple to use it. It's kind of a standard probability timing model to determine who becomes demand and when. There's a chart on the last page of my testimony. It just shows the probability of becoming demand depending on how young you are when first referred. If you're first referred at age 12 or younger, you have the highest probability of becoming demand. And that decreases, you know, if you're first referred at 17, you have the lowest probability. For 12-year-olds, it takes several years before they become demand, as the chart shows. This shows in every month after turning 12, what's the probability by the time they turn 15, the probability peaks and stays there till they turn 17. We're able to use the same kind of analysis for the other two non-discretionary populations. And finally, there you have our most recent forecast. Our next one will be out next week. On page 2 is a chart that shows the total closed custody demand forecast. That's everybody together, the adult court, public safety reserve, and the demand for discretionary bed allocations. And it's relatively flat. And the previous forecast before that was flat. And what we found is, you know, despite what might go on with referrals, they go down, they go up, this core group of people doesn't change much. And on page 3, there's a box that says characteristics of the TDP, or total demand population. And what we found is that about one-third of kids that are ever referred, just one-third are first referred at age 13 or younger, that two-thirds of the total demand population are composed of kids that were first referred at these young ages. And it takes them, on average, 40 months between when they're first referred and when they either went to the DBA or became demand. It takes, on the average, 40 months, and they've accumulated, on average, 10 referrals by that time. And this also confirms what this ad hoc group is telling us, that this is kind of a core group of offenders that enters the system fairly young. They're chronic offenders, but they never quite do anything that bumps them into the public safety reserve. So they keep working at it, and after, you know, years of chronic behavior, they finally were sent to the discretionary bed allocation.
I'm going to stop you right there and just make an observation. 15 minutes is barely enough time to for an introduction to the subject matter, and it doesn't honor your expertise and what you can bring forward to the discussion. And frankly, the committee needs time to review and digest the information that you've provided in printed form. And so I'm going to suggest that we bring this back for tomorrow. You're able to be with us tomorrow. Is that problematic? If it is, we have the next phase in which we're going to need to have this background information and grounding and fuller understanding anyway. But again, I just want to acknowledge that it took a lot for you to prepare to be here and to provide us what you have, and we haven't even heard from your...
it was all his idea.
from your partner. But again, what I'm trying to communicate to you is that this is a committee that is thoughtful and that is engaged and that wants to have the fullest possible understanding of the information that you're bringing forward. So let's just look at your scheduling at a time that is most appropriate.
Madam Chair, I have about 4 days, including Saturday and Sunday, to finish all this round of forecasting.
Mm-hmm.
So if it's okay with you, I would respectfully request to come back during the next phase when I'll have the new numbers and much more time to
That's
talk.
That's most appropriate. Absolutely.
Thank you.
Well, thank you.
That might be an excellent way to start off these people.
That's a great suggestion, Representative. Baker's taking a note of that.
Thank you.
And would you like to introduce yourself for the record, sir, just so we can acknowledge that you were also present?
for the record, Madam Chair and members of the committee. This is Dave Beck, Deputy State Economist. I worked on this issue with Sue Porter and our demographer in our office.
Thank you very much for being present.
Thank you.
Members, I want to draw your attention to just a few items before we adjourn. You do have a couple of articles, thanks to Ms. Baker for doing this research for us. Two articles from the Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies, one titled Racial Disparity in the Justice System, More Than a Sum of Its Parts, Bias Infects System from Investigation to Incarceration, and then another titled Black Youth Captured by Foster and Justice Systems. And you also have a copy of the Oregon Progress Board report looking at the progress of Oregon's racial and ethnic populations. And this is not their most recent report. It's from November 2002, but it still has a lot of value. Also want to...
Madam Chair, yes. I would just clarify, this is their most recent published report.
Published
they
report.
Weren't sure when they would come out with a new one.
Okay. Thank you very much. And then also I want to announce that we will carry over Senate Bill 5530, the Oregon Youth Authority Budget Bill, for a public hearing on Thursday, March 17th. And again, I thank Mr. Jester and all of the good folks from the Oregon Youth Authority for their participation, the quality of your participation, and we'll see you on tomorrow.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you.
And we are adjourned.